This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Almost a quarter of the land in the Northern Hemisphere is frozen, but this permafrost is thawing much faster than anyone thought possible. On our current course, almost half could be gone by the end of this century, rearranging the landscape and emitting massive amounts of greenhouse gases. Later in this program, we will talk with the lead author of the new study. But our first guest is the distinguished climatologist and geophysicist, Dr. Michael E. Mann. He's the director of the Earth System Science Center at Pennsylvania State University, author of three books, and the famous target of climate deniers for his early recognition of rapid global warming, dubbed the hockey stick graph. Michael Mann just testified to a rigged committee at the House of Representatives. He's also the lead author of New Science that shows how our weather has become more extreme due to human greenhouse gas emissions. Michael Mann, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. It's great to be with you.
Why do you think climate science is being attacked and dismantled by the government of the United States?
Well, there's really no other way to characterize it. The implications of the science, namely that we need to do something about our ongoing burning of fossil fuels and escalating greenhouse gas emissions that are warming the planet, the fact that we need to do something about that is a threat to the fossil fuel interests that fund the campaigns of folks like Donald Trump and congressional Republicans who are essentially acting as advocates for those special interests and doing everything they can to attack the science, to attack the scientists, and, as you know, to dismantle science-based policies to do something about the problem.
And you recently appeared on Capitol Hill at a hearing of the House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology. How did that go?
Well, I was the sole representative, really, for sort of the mainstream scientific viewpoint, and there were three other witnesses who are all rather in the fringe of that small fringe of scientists who either do not accept the science, deny the basic science, or downplay the impacts of climate change. It's not surprising, the chair of the committee, Lamar Smith, Texas Republican, whose greatest contributors are all fossil fuel interests. They fund his campaigns, and in return, he has used, some would say abused, his authority as chair of the House Science Committee to use it as a tool to issue indiscriminate attacks against the science of climate change and climate scientists.
Can you list just a couple of fronts in this new war against climate science where the administration is trying to kill off either research or public information?
Yeah, so really it's a multi-pronged strategy on their part. Trump has appointed to key positions within his administration climate change deniers and lobbyists and individuals with strong ties to the fossil fuel industry. Look at his Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, the former CEO of the world's largest fossil fuel corporation, ExxonMobil. And if you look at who he's appointed to the EPA, Scott Pruitt. Scott Pruitt was the former Attorney General of Oklahoma, who spent most of his time as Attorney General suing the EPA to try to prevent them from regulating carbon emissions, and spent much of his time ghostwriting policy papers that had actually been written by fossil fuel interests, who, again, fund his campaigns. So the fact that someone like Scott Pruitt, who spent his time as Attorney General of Oklahoma attacking the EPA and attacking efforts to deal with climate change, is now heading up the EPA, is a very clear indication of how the foxes are now guarding the hen house when it comes to environmental regulation. Look at his Department of Energy Secretary, Rick Perry, who is also a climate change denier. If you look at many of the other individuals who have been appointed to cabinet-level positions or high-level positions within various government administrations, and it's like a who's who of Koch brothers affiliates. And it's very clear that the Koch brothers, the largest privately held fossil fuel interest and major funders of the public relations campaign to deny and attack the science of climate change, they have a level of influence now within the Trump administration unlike anything we've ever seen before. And, of course, we have willing accomplices when it comes to congressional Republicans. It seems like the one thing they've actually been able to agree upon, the administration and congressional Republicans, is their agenda of dismantling environmental protections. And even as other aspects of Trump's agenda have run into roadblocks, that effort to dismantle environmental protections is proceeding with remarkable pace, and it's very worrying.
Yeah, it looks like they're going into a lot of detail. They just find the word climate anywhere and fire everybody around it. So at the recent meeting in Italy, the United States prevented a joint statement by the G7 group of wealthy economies to endorse the Paris Climate Agreement. Is that serious?
Yeah, of course it is, because this is how this necrotizing infection spreads, right? The Trump administration, well, they have, you know, some degree of control over our own climate policies and energy policies, but there's only so much damage that they can do through changing our policies alone. After all, we're just one country. We're responsible for, you know, somewhere in the range of 4 to 5% of global carbon emissions. That's not trivial, but obviously progress can still be made as long as everybody else is on board, as long as all the other countries, the other G7 nations are on board, and the nearly 200 nations around the world who've committed to the Paris Accord to make dramatic cuts in carbon emissions. So where the infection spreads and becomes dangerous is in the efforts by the Trump administration to, in essence, hijack multinational efforts to do something about the problem, to throw a monkey wrench into the works, you know, when it comes, for example, to this latest effort of all the other G7 nations, all the other industrial nations who are ready to sign on to a fairly forward-looking, proactive statement about the urgency of acting on climate. And the sole holdout was the United States. They refused to sign on to the statement, and that meant that ultimately a consensus statement of the G7 nations could not be issued. And so that's where the Trump administration is starting to impact larger global efforts to do something about this problem. If the U.S., for example, if Trump makes good on his threat to withdraw from the Paris Accord, well, then that potentially could damage the rather fragile agreement reached, again, by nearly 200 nations operating in good faith to find common ground in how we're going to go about this transition away from fossil fuels toward renewable energy and avoid catastrophic climate change. When one of the world's two largest emitters, which is the U.S., China's currently the largest emitter, when one of the world's largest emitters unilaterally withdraws from the agreement, that, of course, provides cover, right, for other countries to say, well, hey, if the U.S. is pulling out, then why should we do this? Fortunately, thus far, even in the face of, you know, Trump and his administration's intransigence, China, who's the largest emitter, as I mentioned earlier, has remained steadfast. They've said that they are still going to make good on their commitments, and in fact, they are even exceeding their commitments when you look at the fact that they're now decommissioning coal-fired power plants and investing much more in renewable energy than any other nation in the world. So one can still look to, you know, a country like China for optimism that perhaps the agreement will hold. But the real threat here is that this cancer spreads, that the Trump administration's very backward-looking policies on energy and climate begin to infect larger global efforts and agreements to act. That's where the real threat is. And with this latest action at the G7 summit, that's an indication that, again, that the infection, the cancer, is beginning to spread.
In Time magazine, April 8th, you wrote about the single shining hope to stop climate change. What is that hope?
Well, the hope is that, you know, in short, the world is ready to move on, right? Fossil fuels are an antiquated technology. Just as we moved away from whale oil in the 19th century because it just no longer made sense, the same thing is now true of fossil fuels. And we're seeing a remarkable trend when you look at the price for renewable energy, solar, wind, geothermal, et cetera. We're seeing these sort of economies of scale and efficiencies that are now causing these alternative sources of energy to be competitive with fossil fuel energy sooner than we thought that would be. And that's even without any agreed upon price on carbon. So even in a playing field that's not yet even, because after all, fossil fuel, the burning of fossil fuels is doing damage to the planet, and there should be a cost with a price on carbon. And if there were to be a price on carbon, then renewable energy would be even more competitive. But even without that price on carbon, we're seeing huge increases in efficiency and in market share of renewable energy. And that's, you know, that's where the world's headed. It's pretty clear. And ultimately, the real question now is whether the U.S. is going to get on board with what I would characterize as the greatest revolution of the last century, the renewable energy revolution, whether we're going to get on board or we're going to get left behind as the rest of the world does move ahead. So that's the good news. We're going to, there's no question that transition is underway and it's unstoppable. The problem is that it has to happen even faster than the current trajectory that we're on if we are going to avoid burning enough carbon to lock in dangerous and potentially catastrophic impacts on our climate.
Good. Well, tell us about the Scientist March on April 22nd.
Yeah, so this is, you know, it's sort of this organic effort that sprung up from the scientific community. I think there's a collective feeling among scientists in this country that science is under assault right now in a way that we've never seen before, certainly climate science, where Trump is doing everything he can to defund the science, and Congress is actually engaging in witch hunts, attacking climate scientists, like the one I testified at a couple weeks ago. The attacks on the science continue, and they're escalating, and it isn't just climate science. You know, Trump administration wants to cut the National Institutes for Health by a fairly healthy percent. I forget the exact percent, but a fairly sizable cut in their budget. And really across the board, we're seeing an effort to defund science, or at least any science that doesn't have immediate sort of corporate spin-offs, any science that doesn't directly, you know, aid vested interests, pure science and science aimed at the public good, whether it's health, the health of people in the form of the National Institutes for Health and medical research they support, or, you know, climate research, which is ultimately about the health of our entire planet, and any other environmental research, you know, with huge cuts to the EPA, with cuts to NOAA and NASA, there's an effort to defund that science. But more than that, there is this sort of rejection of really the Enlightenment, the teachings. There's a rejection almost of the tradition of science to aim to ask questions and provide objective answers. That is a threat to vested interests who don't like the answers, who don't like what scientists are finding, whether it's stem cell research or evolution or climate change or any number of topics. And that's why I think you're seeing this groundswell of support. Scientists of all stripes, young, old, from all different fields, coming together and deciding, you know, as much as scientists would prefer to spend their time doing science, and I can tell you as a scientist, you know, I'd be perfectly happy just left alone in my lab, doing calculations, working with my students, trying to advance our knowledge, and teaching the next generation of scientists. That's what scientists prefer to spend their time doing. But when science is under an assault like the current one that we're witnessing, ultimately scientists will come out and will speak up. And that's why you're going to see, you know, something that at least in my lifetime is unprecedented, scientists literally marching in the streets of Washington, D.C., and I understand that there'll be satellite marches all around the country in protest of this, the current political atmosphere, the current anti-science political atmosphere. I think that scientists' voices will be heard on April 22nd.
This is Radio EcoShock. My guest is Dr. Michael Mann, the Distinguished Professor of Atmospheric Science at Penn State University. Now we're going to try and squeeze in a little bit of talk about the real climate science that affects you directly. Dr. Mann is the lead author of an article published March 27th in the journal Nature. The title is Influence of Anthropogenic Climate Change on Planetary Wave Resonance and Extreme Weather Events. Michael, what is the central question you and your authors addressed?
Thanks. It's quite a mouthful, isn't it? And yeah, that's the title is sort of loaded with fairly scientific, with fairly jargonish sort of science speak. But ultimately, what we were looking at was actually not that complicated. What we're asking is climate change changing the behavior of the jet stream in a way that may lead to this phenomenon we've seen so much of in recent years. A lot of the extreme weather events that we've seen, the major droughts and wildfires and floods and heat waves, particularly in the spring, summer, and early fall during that part of the year, many of those extreme and persistent weather disturbances have been associated with a particular type of behavior where the jet stream gets extremely wavy. So, you know, the jet stream, you know, undulates as it crosses the country, and where it heads north, you get what's called a ridge, and then where it comes back south, you get a trough, and it carries weather systems along with it. And the larger those ridges and troughs, the more pronounced the regional weather impacts are going to be. So when you have a very large sort of waviness in the jet stream, and especially if the jet stream essentially gets stuck so that those peaks and troughs remain in the same place for day after day, that's where you get these extreme prolonged weather anomalies, like the 2010 California wildfires, the 2011 Oklahoma and Texas drought and heat wave, the 2003 European heat wave, the 2010 Russian wildfires, and the huge flooding that they had at the same time in Pakistan. All of those were associated with that type of behavior of the jet stream. What our latest study shows, using climate models and observations, is that the pattern that favors that configuration of the jet stream is becoming more prevalent over time, and using the climate models, we're able to show that that is a result of human-caused warming of the planet. And without going too much into the details, it has to do with the fact that the polar regions are warming faster, the Arctic is warming even faster than the rest of the world because of the melting ice, and that accelerates the warming. You get even more warming in the Arctic than you get down here in middle latitudes. And that change in the pattern of warming as you go north-south actually influences the jet stream. And it turns out it influences the jet stream in a way that makes that particular pattern that we're talking about more prevalent. So we do think now that there's a fairly clear connection between human-caused warming of the planet and the increased incidence of some of these unprecedented weather extremes that we've seen in recent years.
Is the science getting closer to helping meteorologists predict extreme weather events so we could get more public warning, or maybe governments could prepare better?
Yeah, it's a great question. And while we haven't looked at, you know, how this particular method could be operationalized, we have every reason to believe that it could. The conditions that we're talking about are indeed predictable in some sense, in sort of the near term. You can see them coming, you know, a week in advance potentially. And so, yes, there could be some applications of the same research to improve forecasting of extreme weather events. And that's something that we as a group are pursuing. We're also now looking not just at the historical changes, but now looking into the future using climate model simulations, projections of the future. How likely are we to see further increases in incidence of these types of conditions as the warming proceeds? So stay tuned. We hope to have answers to those questions in the near future.
The late American scientist Stephen Schneider wrote the book Science is a Contact Sport. And looking at your recent years, Michael, the attacks, your work, the appearances, all your appearances, maybe you should have written that, but please tell us about your most recent book and any updated editions that you may have for us.
Thanks. Yeah, so I've written a few books now, The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, back in 2012, which is about my experiences sort of in the crosshairs of climate change denialism and my tangles with politicians, climate change denying politicians, and 2008, and then we revised it for the latest IPCC report, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, in 2012, Dire Predictions, Understanding Climate Change, which is a fairly straight-up graphics and picture sort of driven review of the entire science, the physical science behind climate change, the projected impacts, and the solutions, what we can do about the problem. Then most recently now, back this fall, September, in fact, I published a book co-authored with Tom Tolles, who is the cartoonist, the editorial cartoonist for the Washington Post. And Tom has done lots of cartoons about climate change and climate change denial in particular, and the hypocrisy of climate change denying politicians over the years. And we decided to combine forces and write a book that sort of uses his cartoons to tell, again, the story of the science, the impacts, the politics, and sort of looking forward to the solutions. It's sort of interesting. This fall, when we published the book, many of our colleagues sort of said, well, you know, why are you guys writing a book about climate change denial? Aren't we past all of that now? We're ready to move on. And, of course, then we had the election. And history had another viewpoint. And, you know, with the election of Donald Trump, we now have, you know, a chief executive who is a climate change denier and is using his power to enforce a policy, a governmental policy of climate change denial. So we are very much back in the madhouse. And, you know, I think the book now has this salience or even prescient feeling because, indeed, it's far more relevant now than we possibly could have imagined when we published this book back in September. Ultimately, we try to take sort of a lighthearted approach, using humor and satire and, you know, ridicule where appropriate, you know, to talk about the issue, but in a different way. And maybe get some people who thus far have tuned out. Maybe we can get their interest with this sort of comic, satirical approach to the issue of climate change.
Well, I'd say maybe Donald Trump should read your book, but he probably doesn't read books, but I'm sure he could get the cartoons.
Exactly.
Thank you so much for sharing your valuable time with us.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
I've been a fan of climate progress blogger Joe Rome for years. He just wrote, "Global warming will defrost much more permafrost than we thought." A new study finds every 1 degree C, or 1.8 degree Fahrenheit, of additional warming would thaw 1/4 of the Earth's frozen tundra area, releasing staggering amounts of heat-trapping greenhouse gases, end quote. Hold that thought. The implications of new research published April 10th are deep and very serious, but it took years of work to find the real measure of thawing permafrost. I've reached the lead author of that study. Dr. Sarah E. Chadburn is a postdoctoral research fellow in the United Kingdom at the University of Leeds. Sarah Chadburn, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi.
How do we know that permafrost is thawing faster over larger areas in the last couple of decades?
So in the last few decades, we've seen a lot of warming in the Arctic, and in terms of permafrost, it's actually quite difficult to measure what's happening on a large scale because it tends to be deep under the ground, and we can't measure it from satellites. But what we do have are smaller-scale studies where people have gone out and measured the permafrost, and they've found in a lot of cases the permafrost is either warming up or it's thawing or the thawing is accelerating.
Well, let's picture that the fossil fuel magnates conquer politics as they appear to have done in the United States. We don't act in time, and the world warms at least 2 degrees by the year 2100. What happens to the permafrost?
So first of all, if we stayed with this kind of business as usual scenario, and actually we're going to see a lot more than 2 degrees of warming by 2100. In fact, we could see up to 5 degrees, and we looked at this in our study, and under 5 degrees of warming, we would lose almost all of the permafrost. But if we manage to keep under 2 degrees of warming, which is the upper limit on the Paris Agreement, then we would still lose quite a lot of the permafrost. In fact, more than 40% of it would thaw.
Now, when you say we could lose all of the permafrost, I presume that you're not meaning by 2100, but that it would happen over the following centuries, or can it happen very quickly?
So in some areas, it can thaw very quickly. It would take maybe a couple of decades. But then in other areas, it could take 100 years or more to thaw.
Well, what if we manage to hold warming to 1.5 degrees C, just half a degree less than the 2-degree alleged safety limit? How much permafrost could we save?
So in that case, we would save around 2 million square kilometers of permafrost.
Then why should we try to save the permafrost? Won't it all melt anyway, sooner or later?
Well, first of all, if we manage to stabilize the climate at 1.5 or 2 degrees or something around there, then, in fact, more than half of the permafrost is not going to thaw, and it's going to be preserved. The permafrost is important globally, as I expect we'll discuss later on, but it's also important in itself because of the ecosystems that are there and the animals and plants and people that live there.
Well, right. I'm hearing two streams of worry from scientists and people in the north. The first is about clogging northern rivers and coastlines with thawed muck from these ages past, and the whole landscape can sag or rise or become very unstable. Can we say global warming is driving geologic scale change in the north all around the world?
Yeah, we can. So I said earlier that we can't really directly measure permafrost from a satellite because it's deep under the ground, but we can measure these kind of geologic changes that are associated with permafrost thaw. So there was a paper in 2005 where they looked at satellite images and they showed that as the permafrost starts to thaw, there's these new lakes that are forming, which can be seen from space, and then as it thaws even more, then the lakes start to drain and disappear. So you really do have big changes.
And the second concern, of course, is about more greenhouse gases flowing out of the permafrost. What are the pathways and the gases released as land thaws?
So, yeah, exactly. That's a big concern. So the main two greenhouse gases that you expect from permafrost thaw are carbon dioxide and methane. And these, which one is released, depends really on the hydrology. So that's how wet the ground is. So if the ground is very wet, you get methane. And if it's drier, then you get carbon dioxide emitted. These gases, actually, they're not stored in the ground as gases. They're either stored in organic matter. So that's like the remains of dead plants and animals, which are frozen into the ground. So it's like if you put some food in the freezer or something, it doesn't rot. When the permafrost thaws, then it starts to rot. And it decomposes and turns into these greenhouse gases. And then there's also these things called methane hydrates, which are kind of a scary thing because they can be released very, very quickly from the ground, and that releases methane.
Okay, so there's methane hydrates in the ground as well. I've read about them in the ocean on the sea bottom. It's like sort of a formation of ice and methane all mixed together. I didn't know that they were also in the land.
Yeah, there is some on land. So that's not really my speciality, but I'm certainly aware that there is some.
Now, can greenhouse gases from thawing permafrost become a positive feedback loop where more creates more? And if that's true, could you describe how it might work?
Yeah, I think it's quite simple, really. So once you have these greenhouse gases released, then those add to global warming, like through the greenhouse effect. And this can cause more permafrost to thaw, which can then lead to more emissions of gases, and then this is an amplifying effect. We call it, yeah, like you said, a positive feedback. And there's actually a lot of different feedbacks in the climate system, and some of them are positive, which means they amplify the warming, and some of them damp the warming. And this is one of the positive climate feedbacks.
Well, getting back to senior climate blogger Joe Rome, he also said, quote, "One study found that the feedback from just the CO2 released by the thawing permafrost alone could add 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit to total global warming by 2100 if we don't sharply curtail carbon pollution as soon as possible." Well, we've already added almost 1.5 degrees already. Of course, that's centigrade. It sounds like permafrost decay alone could equal or exceed all human emissions to date. That's hard to believe. Let's get some discussion going. Is that possible?
So I guess it is possible, but I would say it's pretty unlikely from what we understand so far. Basically, there's a lot of uncertainty in how much of the carbon in the permafrost would be emitted if it thawed. Now, there's a lot of carbon in there. We could end up with that amount of carbon emitted to the atmosphere, but it's actually very unlikely from our modeling studies. So far, we're seeing that maybe an extra, like, few tenths of a degree of warming by 2100 from the permafrost carbon.
Now, when we hear astounding facts like these, though, it's only human to ask, how do you know? So let's work on that. You've been working for years to reconcile the results of large-scale computer models to actual measurements taken across the Arctic. Why do we need a good model for what is happening with the permafrost?
Well, first of all, like I said, it's hard to actually observe the permafrost on a large scale, so it's useful to be able to model it. And then more importantly, we need to understand what's going to happen with it in the future. So that's these carbon releases that we're talking about and the impacts on the land surface. And the only way to really find out what will happen in the future is to model it.
Sarah Chadburn, your earlier work was on the Jules Land Surface Model. What is that?
So that's a model I still work with a lot. It's actually part of the climate model we have in the UK. So the model basically represents the whole Earth, and it's called an Earth System Model. You can probably appreciate it's pretty complex, but it's separated into three parts. And there's the atmosphere part, the ocean part, and the land part, and Jules is actually the land part of that model.
Well, even though it's run by the UK Met Office, it's available to other researchers without a fee. Do you think this adds more possibilities for collaborative research?
Yeah, definitely. And we've seen, so the model has benefited a lot from the input from the scientific community to developing the model and improving it. And then as scientific users outside of the Met Office, we also benefit from the technical support that they have there. So it seems to be a win-win situation.
And your new paper that we're discussing, is it based completely on modeling, or did your team cross-check against developments in various northern countries?
In fact, one of the main things that made our approach stand out from other previous approaches is that we relied much more on observations rather than just using the model. So we actually used the observations to construct our model in the first place, and then we used more observations to cross-check what we were getting out of it. So we basically used as many observations as we could find.
And is it true that the warming estimates in the latest reports by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change do not include any warming due to permafrost thawing?
This is basically right. So the models that they included in the IPCC report, none of the climate models had this permafrost carbon represented. But in the report they do talk about the permafrost carbon and how much potential warming that could add.
All right. Now, what does your new paper say to other climate modelers?
I think the fact that we could reduce the uncertainty on the permafrost thaw using a really simple approach like we've used means that the permafrost really needs to be better represented in the climate models.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest from the University of Leeds is Sarah E. Chadburn. We're talking about how thawing permafrost could radically change the world you live in. Permafrost research is going on all around the world. It's fascinating stuff. One study by Canadian scientists showed the thaw is revealing the outlines of an ancient glacier. Sarah, do you think the subsoil has a memory?
Well, there's very long timescales involved in the soil, so in a sense, yes. There's things that are in there have been in there for thousands of years. Like, you can dig down into the permafrost and find whole roots and pieces of plants that have been there since thousands of years ago, and they're still in the soil.
And in the popular press and alternative blogs that I look at, we see a lot of sudden eruptions in Siberia, likely caused by methane. And we get photos of millions of small round lakes appearing pretty suddenly across the Siberian bogs. I think people don't realize almost a quarter of the Northern Hemisphere is still frozen. We certainly have a lot of it in Northern Canada. And we're worried about this possible mass release of carbon dioxide and methane, as we talked about. But I ran across a scientist who reportedly reduces that concern. Suzanne Tank is a scientist at the University of Alberta in Canada. She told a reporter from Inside Climate News that the majority of carbon from the Canadian thaw is released as coarse particles that don't convert to CO2 right away. Should we worry less because of that?
So I don't think we should. I mean, we already know that we don't expect it to be immediate release of greenhouse gases, but we expect it to occur over the next century or so. So yes, it's a slow process. But then there are some aspects that can be faster, like this methane release that I mentioned.
Well, given the very rapid warming of the Arctic, I'd like to see some sort of multinational war room for models and observations and a database of solutions, a central international authority or something. At least ways for humans and other creatures to adapt could be in there as well. Given the threat, do you think we are doing enough?
So in terms of what's being done on the ground in terms of adaptation in the Arctic, I'm not really sure what's going on there. In terms of actually reducing the warming to kind of mitigate any of these things happening in the first place, we have this Paris Agreement and we have commitments from the different countries, and the current commitments won't limit the warming to 2 degrees. It's going to be higher, so we still need more to be done.
At the annual meeting of the American Academy for the Advancement of Science in Vancouver 2012, I recorded a workshop of permafrost scientists and one older Canadian scientist who's well known in the field for his decades of patient measurements. He still felt the science of permafrost would not be relevant or popular until later this century. It's a very slow process, he said. Now, just 5 years later, what do you think?
Well, certainly a lot of people are aware of it and aware of the issues now. But I think saying that it's not relevant now, even if it is a slow process, and some of the processes, carbon release will definitely be slow, we're laying the foundations for that future carbon release now, because the permafrost is thawing now, and then it's then irreversible. Once the permafrost is thawed, then the carbon is eventually, it's going to decompose and come out to the atmosphere. But also, we don't, because there is quite a lot of uncertainty about this process, we don't have a good grasp of what the timescale is going to be. Is it going to be a century? Is there going to be some really immediate effects? I think that is something we should be concerned about. And again, even if something's not relevant to the end of the century, it's something that we should still think about, because we should maybe be concerned for future generations.
Just maybe.
Yeah.
It's hard for us to imagine what's happening in this formerly permanently frozen lands of the north. We thought it was permanent, unless you've been there anyway. And the maps are huge. The calculations are huge. Maybe this whole process is still beyond our grasp. Your thoughts?
So I think we're starting to understand it certainly much better than we did. It would really help. So one of the main problems is that it's hard to get observations of permafrost, and there's not any kind of consistent funding for people to do that. And a lot of the other climate variables, like air temperature, for example, those are monitored by government programs that are continuous, whereas there's no kind of continuous government program for permafrost monitoring. So that's something that would be really useful.
Yeah, I think the government in Alaska has some program for monitoring, and Canada does little bits and bats, but you're totally right. I haven't seen sort of an international sustained program to measure permafrost and what's happening.
Yeah, I think that's what we need.
Well, when I look through your past, I see a pretty steady and determined course to refine the tools we need to wrestle with this big problem. What's next for you, Sarah?
So in this recent work, we've been looking at the kind of physical state of the permafrost. But now in the next few years, hopefully, I'm going to be focusing on the carbon side of this. So how much greenhouse gases might be released.
Is there anything else you'd like to talk about or tell our listeners?
I guess I'd like to say thanks to everyone for taking an interest. We've had really a lot of people interested in this study, which is great in terms of raising awareness and inspiring people. So, yeah, thanks.
We've been speaking with Sarah E. Chadburn. In the UK, she's a postdoctoral research fellow at the University of Leeds, School of Earth and Environment. She's also the lead author of a new paper published April 10th, 2017 in the journal Nature. The title is An Observation-Based Constraint on Permafrost Loss as a Function of Global Warming. You can find links to all the science we've discussed in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Sarah, thank you so much for helping us out.
Thanks, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
Food can be about security, guilt, pleasure, climate, the future we choose, or who we are. And just when we know the green goal of food correctness, I get this headbender in the mail, The Vegetarian's Guide to Eating Meat, A Young Woman's Search for Ethical Food. The author is Professor Marissa Landrigan. She's an engaging American writer whose essays appear in The Atlantic, Salon, Guernica, and Orion magazines. From the University of Pittsburgh, Marissa, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks so much for having me, Alex.
Are you a foodie?
I think I am a foodie, though to be honest, I cringe a little bit at that term. Foodie sounds to me so elitist, and the truth is that the food choices that I make are ones that I hope become easy and accessible for a lot of people to make.
Well, you're at least a generation younger than I am, but we both grew up in the suburbs knowing food came from the supermarket, of course. We didn't really learn to cook for ourselves, maybe didn't have to. And I'll bet that describes a lot of people, maybe most people in the Western-style world, at least at a younger age. How does that happen?
It's really a striking thing, and what's especially surprising about it to me is that I grew up in a family where food was really important, and in fact, we spent a lot of time cooking. My mother's side of the family is Italian-American. They made their own pasta. We had these day-long cooking fests, but we still largely shopped at grocery stores, bulk stores, and I managed to make it till I was in college, I think, before I actually had a really good look at what a modern American industrial farm looked like.
And you chose vegetarianism. At what age and why?
I was about 20 when I decided to become a vegetarian. It was my second year at college, and it was because I saw a PETA video, the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. I saw what a factory farm looked like for the first time. I saw how animals were kept and raised, and I saw how they were slaughtered, and it horrified me. And I thought that the only way to avoid participating in such an unethical, immoral system was to boycott meat consumption completely.
And that was in Ithaca, New York, where we've been broadcasting for quite a few years.
Yes, that's right. Ithaca was, I have to be honest, a wonderful place to become a vegetarian. Though I ate my first vegetarian meals in the dining hall, Ithaca College in particular has a pretty welcoming attitude about other dietary choices.
Well, one phrase from your book echoes in my mind because it applies to so many things. You write about an enormous amount of suffering that happened behind closed doors. What does that mean to you now?
Well, what it means to me now is to remember how much of that suffering that sort of remains behind closed doors applies to many different sort of forms of diets, basically. Well, initially, I was shocked to discover the suffering that animals underwent in this sort of industrial agriculture system. But over the course of my time as a vegetarian and since then, I've discovered a lot of other closed doors and a lot of other sources of suffering. For example, the rather horrifying conditions that many undocumented migrant farm workers live and work in, the fact that farming is the third most dangerous job in the United States, and that farmers have higher rates of cancer and toxic chemical poisoning than any other industry. Now, that to me is an enormous kind of suffering, and it's one that can be applied to either a vegetarian or an omnivorous diet. Vegetarians eat produce. A lot of that produce is sprayed with pesticides, and unfortunately, that pesticide use works back on the migrant workers.
But wait a minute, I want to think about myself as pure when I eat my veggies.
Right, exactly. And I think the problem is that we've spent too much time establishing this binary where vegetarian diets are always good and meat-based diets are always ethically inferior to vegetarian diets. And I think the real picture is a little bit more complicated than that. The truth is that many of our dietary choices contribute to some form of suffering, and there is such a thing as an ethical diet that includes meat and an unethical diet that is largely vegetarian.
Well, yeah, you write about, as a 20-something in Washington, D.C., working for the Wilderness Society, your vegetarian diet was actually pretty awful. Tell us about that.
Yes, I was not a very good vegetarian, especially in my early years. I had went from the dining hall to learning to cook on my own, and I had never cooked a vegetarian meal in my life before. So I sort of stuck to the center aisles of the grocery store where mostly the food is processed, pre-prepared, packaged, with lots of additives and preservatives, and I wasn't really experimenting with new ways of thinking about cooking and eating food, new meals that really centered on whole foods and produce, and I was instead sort of sticking to what is actually a fairly traditional American diet, just one that didn't happen to include meat.
How did your vegetarianism go over when you moved to Bozeman, Montana?
Oh, that was a tough transition, though again, I think a lot of the difficulty there was one that I was sort of imposing myself. Bozeman, Montana is a beautiful place and has a long legacy of cattle ranching. Of course, also has a long legacy of hunting. And as a vegetarian, I thought that hunting was something that, again, I should just automatically abhor and be opposed to because it was the death and suffering of an animal. And so that made me immediately very alienated from a lot of the people of Bozeman who were, in fact, probably eating a much more close to the source local diet than I was as a vegetarian. So again, by falling back on that binary where I assumed by not eating meat I was sort of morally superior, I ignored a system of food that involved some hunting, but hunting in a way that was really sort of sustainable as part of the ecosystem.
Then you arrive in California, the land of food plenty, only to discover that, quote, 47% of adults in Ventura County live in food insecure households. How is that possible?
Food insecurity is a huge issue in this country and really globally. One of the things that I think is so important to acknowledge when it comes to these closed doors of suffering is the number of people on this planet who don't have access to enough food, period. So when we have questions about whether small-scale sustainable farming, for instance, can successfully feed the world, the first thing that I always think is, well, we're not currently feeding the world. Industrial agriculture leaves a lot of people out in the cold. It has a lot of waste inherent in the system, and lots of people still go hungry.
So how did Michael Pollan and his book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, change your life?
Well, I had a funny thing happen when I read The Omnivore's Dilemma. I happened at the time to live in Ames, Iowa, which is where one of the very first scenes in the book takes place. So he was literally writing about my backyard at the time, and specifically he was writing about the corn-soy monoculture of most of the American Midwest and the farming landscape there, and how it contributed to the industrial production of meat. And it got me thinking about the ways in which the industrial agriculture system went beyond just a system of livestock production, that it was also a system of producing vegetables and produce and other forms of food that I was eating as a vegetarian. And so it was really the thing that started to complicate the picture for me a little bit, that first made me think maybe there's another path. Maybe there's a third way, something in between vegetarianism and meat eating, and something that focuses more on the method of production rather than on necessarily the end product of that production in the form of the meal itself.
Interesting. So, Marissa Landrigan, talk to us about the corporate connections to the organic food industry, and is there anything wrong with that?
Well, I think that in general, the fact that more and more corporations are producing organic food does say something positive about the market, right? The demand for organic food is going up, and these corporations are recognizing that. I think that is certainly a positive. I think the problem comes when people assume, again, that by buying vegetarian food or organic food, they are automatically buying into an ethical system when that may not necessarily be the case, unfortunately. For example, the Kraft Heinz corporate conglomerate, which is now a single company, owns and produces the Oscar Mayer brand of meat products, one that many of us would consider to be pretty low on the totem pole in terms of healthy and sustainable meat production, right? Bacon, hot dogs, all that. Kraft Heinz also owns and produces Morningstar and Garden Burger, two of the most popular brands of vegetarian meat substitute products. And so whether you're buying Oscar Mayer or you're buying a Garden Burger, your food dollars are ending up in the same hands. That, I think, is a problem. So I'm all for corporations getting in the organic game because, as I said, I think it results from an increased demand in organic. But I want consumers to be aware of where they're really spending their money. And I think they might be better off spending that money at a local farm, whether it's organic, whether it grows meat or not, than by spending it and giving it back to the same company that's going to produce the Oscar Mayer wieners.
Okay, well, on that topic, just between you and me, is the McDonald's vegetarian burger a good choice?
Well, I think it all depends on what you mean by good, Alex. It's probably the best available choice there, and sometimes you've got to go with the best available choice. Although I do have to say I have had it, and in terms of taste, it is not necessarily what I would call a good choice. I would rather pack myself some granola bars before I take the road trip and have to settle for the McDonald's veggie burger.
You do use two words that don't fit well together, humane slaughter. Those aren't pretty words, are they? But you're looking at that, aren't you?
That's right. I think that's really the key to it. We don't like to look at some of the suffering that's inherent in our food system. But the truth is that eating as a human is almost always going to contribute to some form of suffering, human suffering, animal suffering. And there's very little that we can do, I believe, to completely 100% of the time avoid contributing to or causing that suffering. So for me, it's really about how can we minimize that suffering? What can we do to reduce the harm that we cause? And I think part of that has to come in the form of opening our eyes up to it and acknowledging that suffering has to be a part of a food system in some ways and in some places. I think it's not until we acknowledge that that we can really do anything to minimize the harm. And some of the most humane treatment of animals that I've seen has happened inside a slaughterhouse where all of the people involved in killing and processing the animal were very aware of what they were doing, very mindful of it, and therefore took it quite seriously and really ritualized it to the point where it felt like a ritual of respect and an understanding of the sacrifice.
And your book isn't a lecture. It's really a story, and a story about your life. It's very personal. And your travels for work and education and love took you to places you never thought you'd be, like Iowa and then Kansas. Looking back, I want to ask, did that part of your life make sense, or do we weave a sensible story to fit anything that happens?
I think that it's a little bit of both, really. I mean, it all made sense at the time. Every step I took, I thought, sure, why not? This is the next logical step to take. But I absolutely think that some of it is sort of retrospectively now weaving some sense of narrative and meaning out of that wandering. Now, from the other side of it all, I can see the ways in which each of those places really had an impact on me and the way that I saw the ideas of food and home and land and community. But I think at the time, it was much more short-sighted, much more direct. But I'm really glad to hear that it does feel more like a story than a lecture, Alex, because that was really my goal, is to tell my story and to sort of detail the process, because it was a long and winding and meandering and wandering process that, yes, sometimes didn't make sense, but now has sort of gotten me to a place where I feel really sort of stable and secure in the food choices that I make. And so my hope was really that by simply sharing my own story, I might be able to help other people figure out their own path rather than just dictate a path for them.
But we do have studies showing that eating a lot of red meat can lead to heart disease and cancer. What are your thoughts?
Yes, absolutely. I don't have any problem with suggesting that Americans in particular, but people in developed countries in general, should eat significantly less meat, and less red meat specifically. There are two things that I would say, however. The first is that it's important to recognize that not all meat is created equal, that many of these studies suggest that meat that is raised on a grass-based diet rather than a corn or soy diet doesn't have as significantly negative a health impact on the eater as meat that is industrially raised or produced. But I think that in general, a healthier diet is one that involves less meat. Right now, most Americans eat much, much more protein than their bodies actually need. And most of it comes from red meat sources in particular. And we're going to need to cut back on that to be healthier for our own bodies, but also to have less of an impact on the land, because red meat contributes most significantly to global warming as a result of agriculture. And so I think that we'll need to reduce the amount of meat that we eat overall, and we'll also need to change the way that we raise that meat.
You know, it's so complex because, on the other hand, I have listeners who follow the work of Alan Savory, and he showed that great herds of animals properly managed can put lots of carbon back into the soil, and that could be important to reducing climate change. Have you encountered that argument for eating red meat?
Yes, absolutely. And for many, many things, for many ways where livestock can actually be a really sustainable and helpful part of an ecosystem. I think that this is one of the reasons why what we really need to do is find a way to focus on localized food economies, because each location is going to have a different set of needs and a different set of logical inputs to make the most out of the resources that are available in that particular location. And some of those locations, it will make sense to incorporate animals. For instance, one thing that a lot of people have been reading about and discussing lately is the possible negative impacts on the South American food system of the increased demand for quinoa as it becomes a more popular food staple for people in developed countries. And one of the side effects that we've seen in South America is that more and more farmers are reducing the size of their llama populations that they're raising, because they're devoting more and more of their land to the growth of quinoa and less of it to grazing llamas. Producing fewer llamas means that they also produce less fertilizer in the form of manure, which means that they're having to turn to synthetic fertilizers to grow more quinoa. So the absence of a livestock animal from that food system is actually going to have a negative impact on the environment and on the productivity of that food system.
You talked about localizing your food sources. Have you been able to find ways to do that in the Pittsburgh area?
I have. I'm very, very lucky that the Pittsburgh area has a really great food system in place, and in particular, a restaurant scene that places a really high premium on locally sourced food. So I'm also very lucky that I get to go out to eat and know where my food is coming from quite often as well. There are lots of farmers markets in the area, as well as many, many farms that run CSAs, or community supported agriculture programs. There are farm stands, and there are lots of even just locally owned butcher shops and grocers, and I find that they can often sort of point me in the right direction when it comes to other sources of food.
Marissa, have you encountered any pushback to this new work, perhaps from people who still hold the idealism that you've changed?
Yes, absolutely. I think that probably the pushback that I get the most is from people who are still fundamentally made uncomfortable at the idea that an animal will die for them to eat. And I can understand that. I think there is a way to eat a diet that is ethical and sustainable and primarily vegetarian. And if that's the diet that someone feels most individually ethically comfortable with, I think that's perfectly fine. For me, incorporating meat was, as I said, a way to acknowledge the suffering. And so as long as anyone who wants to remain vegetarian or vegan finds a way to acknowledge the suffering that even that diet includes and finds a way to face it and work to minimize it, then I think we are fundamentally on the same page.
As we wrap up, this book of your life with food sounds like an unfinished journey. Do you have any idea where it goes next?
It will be really interesting to see. I find that from where I am now, really, I think I've figured out a pretty good system in terms of being flexible and forgiving when and how I need to be, but generally adhering to these sort of basic principles. The next step will be really interesting to see how things change is as my family grows. The book just barely mentions that I've recently gotten married, and my husband and I hope to start a family and have children soon, and I have absolutely no idea what it will take to feed a family of more than two. So it will be interesting to see how and whether I can sort of keep up with this kind of ethical shopping and cooking when there are other mouths to feed.
And you'll discover those other mouths have choices of their own, even
exactly.
at a young age. I don't eat that. Don't give me that. Okay, we've been talking with American author and educator Marissa Landrigan, and her newest work goes against the green stream. It's called The Vegetarian's Guide to Eating Meat from Greystone Books. You can find links in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org or check out marissalandrigan.com. Thank you, Marissa. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. We're out of time in more ways than one. Don't forget to support the March for Science on Earth Day, April 22nd. Thank you for listening, and please tune in again next week for more Radio EcoShock.